Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 13th, 2005. Today's session is The Waters of Life, Saving Salmon, Saving Souls, and Safe Water for All Kids. What's Baptism Got to Do with It? Presented by Larry Rasmussen in the Fireside Room, disc number 2005-06.
We probably should have a good round of wade in the water. God's going to trouble the water here. To let the Tate Ministry know that we're ready to go. This is the session that is entitled Waters of Life, Saving Salmon, Saving Souls, and Safe Water for the Kids. What's Baptism Got to Do with It? And it's a continuation of the series that was started last week on the summer theme, Take Off Your Shoes, You're Standing on Holy Ground. It's good to take off your shoes if you're going to wade in the water. And the theme last week always included one element of what's happening with the global economy and how do we think about holy ground when everything is commodity for market exchange. And we'll pick that up again tonight a bit. Water now is among those commodities for market exchange. More and more people are walking around with those plastic bottles and not really trusting water elsewhere, except when it's in one of those plastic containers. More and more corporations that are in the business of water in one way or another are doing what they can to be sure they're securing plenty of water. Are the folks here who have done the winter project on Coca-Cola? Well, that's Coca-Cola is trying to do what it can to be sure it captures water rights. So water is one of those commodities, and I just want to ask what happens when all holy ground is real estate, and when water is an essential of life, is a commodity for market exchange. What happens to our notion of holy ground? And what happens to our notion of the sacraments themselves? But there's another side of it. How does our thinking about the sacraments help us think about the other ways in which we would meet material reality? What's the connection of saving souls and saving salmon and safe water for the kids? I don't want to leave Moses out entirely. We're not going to talk about Moses tonight, although he had lots to do with water, parting seas and all of that. But just as a reminder, the name Moses means drawn from the water. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to finish a little after some remarks with a visual presentation connecting the waters of baptism to the waters of life, a resource created by an Episcopal Environmental Committee in the southern U.S. states. But before we go there, I want us to spend some time in this region. And let me introduce you to a bioregional pastoral letter. I said the other night, I'll be happy when seminaries ordain people like Leroy Hedman, who identified as at his church as pastor and master composter. I ordain you as pastor and master composter. Well, now the Roman Catholic bishops of Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia have written a bioregional pastoral letter entitled The Columbia River Watershed, Realities and Possibilities. And I saw reference to this in a New York Times article entitled Saving Salmon and Souls. what might this unlikely connection, salmon and souls, mean? Archbishop Alex Brunette led the Times writer, Jim Robbins, to the baptismal font at St. James Cathedral in Seattle when Robbins came out to talk to him. And the Archbishop says, the water isn't just sitting there, and then pointed to the movement in the water. We don't baptize people in stagnant water, but flowing water, water that is alive. And I don't know if you know the references of Jesus to living water, and the reference to Jesus as living water is a reference in the Middle East to the distinction between water that comes from springs, flowing water, and cistern water, which can be dangerous. So the waters of life, baptism, and the waters of life, in this case the Columbia River and salmon, was the connection for the Archbishop. The connection was sacramental. Saving souls and saving salmon belong to the same universe. And when we talk about holy ground, that's giving ground a sacramental essence or character. It's seeing ground sacramentally. And I want to talk a bit about this deep tradition in Christianity across many, many of Christianity's expression, namely sacramentalism. It's Roman Catholic, it's Orthodox, it's Anglican, it's Lutheran, it's a deep tradition. All material reality is sacred. All material reality has a value in which we participate, but a value which we do not bestow. Now, the Columbia River watershed, Realities and Possibilities, this bioregional pastoral letter, was addressing the following. Logging and mining and grazing and dam building have over a century left the Great River and its basin in dire straits, if you measure that by its emblem, namely the salmon. The salmon runs, annual salmon run of what one time was estimated to be about 16 million salmon, is now right around 700,000 salmon. Probably no less arresting is the name that the bishops gave the endangered watershed. They call the Columbia River and its basin a sacramental commons. I'm quoting the Archbishop now, talking to the reporter to the time, of the New York Times. We're trying to establish a sacredness in the world around us. Essentially, this sacredness assumes the lead tenet of all sacramentalism, namely the one I said. Material reality bears a value that humans share and humans name, but humans do not bestow. It's the good and very good of the Genesis account. Don Sampson, a Yakima Indian leader, chuckled in response to the Columbia being declared a sacramental commons. Quote, maybe God has spoken to the bishops. He said, I hope the boat gets on board. And then he added in a more serious tone, the church is being upfront in dispelling the myth of manifest destiny and dominion over the earth. That's refreshing and welcome. But, and this is what I want to turn to now, to make what I think is a very important point. Sacramentalism hasn't always been poised over against dominion, over against human beings treating the rest of creation as though its value were only its value to human beings. In fact, the most influential cosmology, the most influential big picture in Christianity that has had influence for 1,000 years is seeing the world in terms of a great chain of being. And that great chain of being is a sacramental vision. So do you get my point? Sacramentalism has not always been seen as over against dominion. It's the great chain of being because this is the picture, and St. Francis holds it, but he has a web of life sacramentalism rather than a dominion sacramentalism. But the great chain of being says that created reality is a kind of overflow of divine reality. So the whole of creation is filled with the presence and the energy of God. The universe is alive for this great chain of being, cosmology. And it's a great chain of being in which God is conceived of as pure spirit, and at the top of the chain, below God in this chain of being are angelic creatures, and just a little lower than the angels are human beings, you and I. I'm collapsing a few centuries here together. All these things don't happen at the same time, and they don't all stay the same way. But men are a little bit higher on the chain than women, because men are associated with religion, all this. We're more reasonable minds and reason, and females are more emotional, associated with body rather than mind. And obviously, it's clear to me anyway, that mind and reason ought to rule emotion and body. But then there are further distinctions, and this happened in Europe as a kind of rationale for conquest and colonization of the rest of the world. White folks are a bit higher among human beings than peoples of color. There's a superiority of white people and white civilization to colored peoples and their ways of life in this chain of being. And then animals, obviously, humans are above animals, other animals in this chain of being, we still talk about higher and lower forms of life. If you really want to insult someone, call them a lowlife. That's chain of being mentality. And then plants and water, soil, the material elements of earth are way down at the bottom. So the closer you get to God in the ascetic ascent of the Christian life, the more you leave earth behind. That's been an extremely influential cosmology way of picturing the universe, and an extremely influential spirituality in a lot of Christianity, and it still holds on in some circles. Now there are all sorts of permutations. The break of St. Francis that Dan is talking about this week, the break of St. Francis, is precisely, he takes the same chain of being in the whole universe alive with the presence of God, and signs. Everything in the universe is a sign of the presence of God. It's sacramental because the visible, tangible world mediates the presence of God. God gets through to us by sensuous means. That's what sacraments are and do. But he turns it into a web, and that's what's happening in ecological theology now. We have a web of life sacramentalism replacing a dominion sacramentalism. And I want to stress this point because sacramentalism has been put together with dominion. Pope Alexander VI, famous bull of donation, simply donated all islands and mainlands discovered and to be discovered 100 leagues to the west and south of the Azores towards India and not already occupied or held by any Christian king or prince as of Christmas 1492 to Isabel and Ferdinand of Spain. The Pope just gave the world, donated the world, if it wasn't already in Christian hands, to Isabel and Ferdinand. The Pope was utterly clear. European Christian monarchs should rule the world, spread civilization, and save the benighted souls of non-Christian brothers and sisters. This was taken on a grand scale in the guise of giving, donation. And this great chain of being cosmology then was carried in the first wave of globalization, probably still the most important one. 1492 following is the first time the global economy was integrated, and it happened when sailors learned to cross the great seas, the Atlantic and the Pacific, and commerce, Christianity, conquest, and colonization all happen as a part of the same process of integrating the economy. Neo-European societies were established on every continent except Antarctica. This great chain of being went along with it, and it was packaging sacramentalism and dominion together. It's an important point not just to understand where we're coming from, it's an important point to say this, because just because ground is holy does not mean it's just. Just because we see the world sacramentally, that is, all material reality is the means by which the presence of God is mediated, doesn't mean that a sacramental universe is going to be a just universe. Superiority of such a racist and cultural caste as this was brutal. Native peoples were killed, their cultures were decimated, they were moved or assimilated on European terms. Slaves suffered the Middle Passage with great loss of life and censure of ensuing threat and fear. And the underlying morality for all of this was both chilling and theological. Again and again, I'm quoting Alfred Crosby, during the years of European imperialism, the Christian view was that all men were brothers. The Christian view that all men were brothers was to lead to persecution of non-Europeans. He who is my brother sins to the extent that he is unlike me. He who is my brother sins to the extent that he is unlike me. That is to say, great chain of being in European and neo-European fashion became the measure of morality as well. Now, I guess this underlines it a different way, that religious cosmology, it's always an inventory of the universe, binds the elements of all things together, establishes sin, virtue, vice, reward on the basis of the outcome, all men are brothers, and is my brother sins to the extent that, it matters immensely what that arrangement of things is. And on the, only to call it sacramental, and it may well be sacramental, is not yet to determine its moral standing. Okay, now what has this got to do with baptism. Plenty, but we're not there yet. In sacramentalism, the power to change hearts is, and I'm quoting now the bishops again from the past bioregional pastoral letter, in the sacramental universe itself, nature bears God's presence. And quoting the letter, throughout history, people have continued to meet the Creator on mountaintops, in vast deserts, and alongside waterfalls and gently flowing springs. In storms and earthquakes, they found expressions of divine power. In the cycle of the seasons and the courses of the stars, they have discerned signs of God's fidelity and wisdom. We still share, though dimly, in that sense of God's presence in nature. That's a sacramentalist understanding. And that's how you would come to the conclusion that the Columbia River and its basin is a sacramental commons. Earth is a sacrament here. It's a disclosure of God's presence by visible and tangible signs, like the waters of baptism and the waters of the Columbia River. Transcendent power is imminent. It's as close as the grain and the grape, the oil, the water, and the wine of the liturgy. It's as close as the fields and the forests and the cascading waterways around us. Those who reverence God's presence in creation and understand themselves as part and parcel of the world as sacrament will, the bishops say, be moved to care for creation as the sacred trust that it is. One quotation from Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of the Orthodox Communions, and then I will go to one last point and then this brief presentation on waters, and then we'll have discussion. In this 1997 symposium on the sacredness of the environment in Santa Barbara, California, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew said, as part of that address, "The Lord suffuses all of creation with his divine presence in one continuous legato, from the substance of atoms to the mind of God. Let us renew the harmony between heaven and earth and transfigure every detail, every particle of life." Maybe we don't need to say much more about the theme of creation as one continuous legato from the substance of atoms to the minds of God. But that in one sentence is the sacramentalist understanding of all things. Unless we want to underscore creation's exuberance. Annie Dillard says, "Extravagance! Nature will try anything once." unless you want to also underline the emphatic note of sacramentalism that this extravagant life is a freely offered gift of God and the medium of grace. It's a gift that is ritually born into the worshipful presence of God and renewed there in contemplative and liturgical practices. That's throughout all the deep traditions of sacramentalism, there's always this theme that life is a gift, that creation is a gift. The medium and the medium of grace. And then one acknowledges that by gathering it up in worship and using the material elements themselves to reenact the cosmic drama of creation and its redemption. So in this tradition, the drama of the liturgy, and baptism included, is this ritual reenactment of cosmic community and nothing less than the drama of creation's redemption. Now, from the Middle Ages on down, it's been shrunk in many traditions to focus on humans and their salvation. But if you look closely, we still are reciting the first article of the Creed from time to time, although people sort of pass over Maker of Heaven and Earth and get on to the second article, Creed, and forget the first. But the drama is still there, and Eucharista is Greek for thanksgiving, and a word implying that liturgy and ritual is the form of people's response to life as a gift. If the bread of heaven is freely shared and equally shared with all as God's own way, and if all are welcome without qualification to this welcome table, then why do we not do likewise for the other tables of the world? If baptism is the water of life for the newborn or for the adult, why do we tolerate diseased water? Unsafe water. That's making the connection between the waters of life and the waters of life, between the elements of the sacrament, the bread and the wine, and the hungers of the world. Why don't we make those connections? Part of it is because of the grip yet of great chain of being. We have turned the waters and the elements into signs and symbols of something else that's important, that's up the chain. They're metaphors, and we don't even think about the other waters or food or the hungry. They become signs and symbols for getting closer to God as spirit at the expense of earth. So, but what is happening now? And I think it's a reformation in process. Is the shift of sacramentalism from its links with dominion theology to web of life sacramentalism. And I'm just going to make one last comment and then go to the little resource from the Episcopal Church. Because I have made this point earlier in the series that to embrace the way of looking at the world expressed in capitalism is to disenchant the world. It's to leech the sacred from the common. It's to leech the numinous from the ordinary. It's not great chain of being, but it's a kind of way of looking at the world in which human beings are the center of value, and all else is plastic. I mean, all else is stuff to be bought, sold, used, consumed. It's an utterly utilitarian treatment of the things of earth. It's a relationship in which we are subject and all else is object, rather than subject to subject, living reality to living reality. So use, utility, and possession come to measure all value. And all of those are relative to human appropriation. and human significance. The human subject determines the value of all else as object. And I think it's killing us spiritually, and is anti-sacramental. Basically, it's anti-sacramental. So the working theology of the global economy is, in my judgment, kind of sharp contrast with the sacramental view of the universe. Now, how to work that out is the difficult issue before us, because the single most powerful human construct of our time is the global economy. And yet, we want to say God's earth is sacred, creation is good. It includes us, but it far surpasses us. We are precious elements of it, but we do not determine its value. So the Episcopal Church has a number of environmental task forces, and they organize them by provinces, which in this particular case, with this particular resource, is a group of the southern states, province four of the Episcopal Church. They have written a catechism of creation, and they have put together a set of materials that go along with it. And one of them is Waters of Baptism, Waters of Life. And I will just share that with you, and then maybe these lights back there. Is that what
No.
Okay, thank you very much. Here's a group trying to Here's a group trying to do. This one can be off too.
Okay.
A group trying to do web of life sacramentalism. From Psalm 104, verse 24 or so. Picking up the theme of Waters of Life in John. We have heard from John tonight in Vespers. Then a little education piece. It's not only the case, maybe they'll tell us here, it's not only the case that water covers 70% of the Earth's surface and only 2.5% is fresh water, less than 1% is accessible for use. 70% of your body is water, liquid. Life emerged from the seas in all likelihood. The waters of the womb remain salt waters. The waters of tears, of joy and sadness are salt water. It's the only natural resource that touches all aspects of civilization, and it's central to life, period. I'm from New Mexico. The largest user of water in New Mexico is agriculture, and the second largest is golf courses. And we've gotten ourselves in a bind. We've got to have the agriculture, markets, and eating. But we've now gotten ourselves in a bind. We've got to have the golf courses too, because we've become dependent upon the tourist dollars. That's about one in five people who lack safe water. This is the Episcopal resource that includes the states of North Carolina, Alabama, and Florida. That's a reference to the locations there on the right-hand side. And these are wetlands that they're working on. They've also turned the church camps into earth literacy locations. And then there are some other projects. One western toilet. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Some advice. You probably didn't think of your baptism in terms of fixing any car or truck leaks, but that's the point that's trying to make here. This is the Diocese of Mississippi where they've got a kind of demonstration house. You see the chain that runs down there? That guides the water down so it just doesn't flow all over and into the tank. Very simple, very effective way. Diocese of North Carolina. I think this may be a reference to St. John the Divine in New York, but I'm not sure. They have a kind of promises related to baptism and care for creation. The United Nations has had an environmental Sabbath program for quite some time. It's an interfaith program, even though it's called Sabbath, an interfaith program of resources from the world's religions on issues like water. Okay. We don't have the video, sorry about that. And here's a couple of websites. Web of Creation is one that you should take a look at. People at Lupin School of Theology in Chicago. I'm good about that. All right, let's have one of these. And we've got a little time. The question that I want to pose to us, you may have other questions, and I welcome those as well as your comments, is this one. How might we make the connections and see water sacramentally? I mean, how does God get through to us on this, to what sacraments are about? In the congregation where Nyla and I are at present, and this is in Santa Fe, so it's high desert, along one side of the sanctuary is the baptismal font. It's the whole side of the sanctuary, because the form of the baptismal font is an acequia. An acequia is the irrigation ditch that the native peoples were using when the Spaniards, the conquistadors, came to that area, and then the Spanish settlers took it over as well, and that's the title acequia. But it's this, the acequia is the baptismal font. So you're looking out of the desert, you're looking at the irrigation ditch, and that's the connection right there. Heidi.
I was going to kind of give a similar example. In the chapel where I've been worshiping the last couple of years, the first thing you see when you walk in is the baptismal font, and it's big, and it pours, it's always running, and the water that flows from the top of the font down into this pool at the ground level is powered by solar energy.
Oh, wow.
And also the pool runs right up against these windows that run along a side of the wall of the chapel that look out into a courtyard. And there's also a pool that is in the courtyard. So it's the outside and the inside in the same kitchen. And I was struck by what you said earlier about in the Bible, Jesus talking of living water and water coming from springs versus cisterns, and how I have never seen, with that exception of this font, a font that wasn't just sitting water that maybe got filled up when there's a baptism, but otherwise sits to the side, and how our physical space of worship can have such a huge impact, not only on our theology, but on how we see water, you know, linking the connection, water is alive, and that whole chain of being, so it kind of puts water on a more equal
What's your
point.
Church's website?
What?
What's your church's website?
Oh, it's actually
is that on Web of Creation?
Yes, there might be pictures. It's at the Lutheran School of Theology.
And it may be, Web of Creation is a very good website. And it may be on there because that's really done out of LSTC.
It is. There's a picture of it on the LST website. LSTC website somewhere.
Okay. Now, I don't want to play down the richness of meanings associated with baptism, the dying and rising with Christ. Nor do I want to play down the fact that we have in tradition after tradition after tradition and religion after religion after religion.
Can you talk
water is associated with purification rites. So to make these connections that you're talking about, I'm talking about, the Episcopalians are talking about, isn't to exhaust the meaning, and I don't want to even begin to imply that. I'm just saying that that there are those important meanings of life around that font and the rest of life, and that those connections need to be made as well. Yes, Stacy.
I have a question more about the Dominionism, if that's okay for you.
Sure.
That way for a while. I'm curious about the fact that our oceans, near borders of land, there's ownership, but then there's neutral zones of where there isn't ownership. But the ethos or the paradigm that land can be owned and how that is changing now, where water is now a commodity. And someone, I don't know if anyone's from Nebraska, but as a part of a seminary class, I stayed with some farmers for a few weeks in Nebraska, and they said that Ted Turner is the largest landowner in the state of Nebraska now.
Yes,
and most of the aquifers and water sources go through his land.
Oh.
And the farmers that I was, or the two farmers that I had stayed with, shared their fear that he's going to control water rights.
Mm-hmm.
And their question was, how can someone own something that is not static and is moving through their land?
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you could speak to the aspect that historically it's been mainly land that has been owned versus water, but now we're moving towards a phase of mm-hmm. the commodity mm-hmm. of water.
Yeah. Well, others may want to pick up on that. I mean, it's not just, even the oceans now, it started out with you didn't own any of the oceans, and then nations have rights out to a certain limit, some 200 miles, mm-hmm. Primarily for fisheries. And mm-hmm. now the fishing stocks are heavily bound, so your fish is going to come more and more from fish farming
mm-hmm.
because ownership has mm-hmm. been extended, or rights to harvest
mm-hmm.
The oceans. In New Mexico, water rights are just a huge, huge issue. There isn't one day that goes by when there isn't an article in the New Mexican Santa Fe paper about water rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely complex because you have senior rights and junior rights depending on how long the people have been
mm-hmm.
on the land. And then there are divisions within those. But based on an assumption that there is something like a right to a water, and that isn't necessarily exactly the same thing as ownership,
mm-hmm.
but it certainly is the same thing as control
mm-hmm.
over the water that mm-hmm. runs through. Yeah, you were going to say something.
It's interesting for me that the current revolt by the indigenous peoples in São Paulo, Brazil, is about the privatization of water.
Yes.
And gas and petroleum.
Yeah, they've tossed out a government for not paying attention.
They did, and our administration has made it very clear that we support the successor to the same person who was thrown out
yeah.
and the same policy of privatization. And there are petroleum companies have 78 lease permits to work 42 sites.
Yeah.
And the people are protesting.
Yeah. This is in Bolivia.
In Bolivia,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I keep having more comments.
Please.
But not just water rights. There's mineral rights. There are development rights. So there's all kinds of rights that you may not have if you own the land. Somebody else may have those rights. So water
mm-hmm.
is one. I wondered in terms of New Mexico's water use, if Intel is number 3. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They've got to be way
yeah.
up on the list there somewhere. So that's our computer chip makers.
Yeah.
So in terms of how we live today and honor water, it's
yes.
I've got my own laptop. I'm
yeah.
complicit in that.
Yeah.
But computer making is hugely.
It was a big issue in New Mexico when Intel proposed that it be located in Rio Rancho, north of Albuquerque. That was a big,
mm-hmm.
big discussion, in large part because of the water use.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision was that it was more beneficial to the economy.
To bring the economy.
Yeah, on balance. And, yeah.
That was also. Wanted to point out the connection between the drought in the Southwest and global climate change. And, certain areas like Minnesota were getting like a lot more water and other places had less. But then more of the moisture will be in the atmosphere, and so people along the tropics will have tons of trouble with floods and hurricanes. And there's going to be a lot of trouble with water because of
yes.
extra energy in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it's going to be distributed very differently, probably, and there will likely be more extremes, whether storms or droughts, because of the reason is increased evaporation, and that makes for more activity. Clouds are fickle. Yeah, right.
You mentioned the Roman Catholics and the Episcopalians. I've heard that the president of the National Association of Evangelicals is a strong environmentalist, some people call him. And I'm wondering if you've read anything written about water or environmental work from that perspective, and how it's similar or different than what you're reading in the other denominations.
Not specifically on water. The National Religious Partnership on the Environment is composed of Roman Catholic, so-called mainline Protestant, evangelical Protestants, and Jews. And the evangelical representation has been very strong in that organization. And there are a number of documents. They do much more than that. They have organized the colleges that identify themselves and a particular network of Christian colleges associated with the evangelical, with evangelical churches. They've taken up a program in the colleges on stewardship. The evangelical term and focus is stewardship. That's what it's about. So there's some good work and strong leadership there.
How do you think they're connecting up with sacramentalism?
Yeah, I don't see that connection, and I don't think it's theologically of any particular importance. I could be wrong about that. But the focus on stewardship is the human's responsibility as a trustee for creation. There's always an affirmation that creation is good, but I don't see it reflected in a discussion about sacraments or a part of the sacramental vision. Now, someone else who can speak to that.
I'm actually going to help you with the answer from
Backways
that Stacy was asking.
Okay.
On the laws of water rights. I'm not sure exactly of the list of states, but in general, the western states of the United States have this trade of water rights to different areas, and the eastern states have riparian water rights, which means anyone who can reach the water can take it.
Which works better?
Depends on who you are.
Yeah, well, one of the differences is in general the eastern states have more water to share among people, and the western states tend to be drier.
I think like the Nebraska farmers that and these are two farmers out of many in Nebraska that I was with, said, does someone have the right to dam on their land, and they're not really necessarily using that water, and it should be coming downstream to where my farmland is, and the question of can it remain static there?
I mean, this is one of the biggest issues or problems when you organize the economy the way we have, on the basis of a kind of privatizing and property, because there are a number of things which are, by their nature, belong to the commons. Mm-hmm. And it's the atmosphere, and it's the ocean, and it's flowing water. Mm-hmm. These things just are not given to the discrete boundaries that is assumed when you work with commodities. They have to be able to be packaged, bought, sold. But if the nature of these elements is that they belong to the commons, and you've got the problems on your hand that we're facing. And how to deal with the commons is the tough issue here. In the back.
Larry, are you familiar with David Suzuki's stewardship pledge that he's
lobbying for in the provinces in Canada?
No.
It's a
he's a leader, but I don't know the
he has a 10-point program, and the goal is at a grassroots level to get a million signatures. And then to be able to go to all the major cities in each of the provinces and say, we have a million signatures. I think he has about, when he spoke in Bellingham, he had about 400,000. Mm-hmm. And say to the politicians, we have a million signatures from across the country for people making a commitment to do these 10 things or some of these 10 things. Can you begin to direct government policy to be shaped by these 10 things? And it's as simple as taking public transportation once a week. It's as simple as when you buy a new appliance, buy an energy conserving appliance. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple in there about water, but it's an effort to begin to move the powers that be from the grassroots that I'm mm-hmm. sort of encouraged by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is a lot happening, Diane.
Kind of in your last comments, something you said earlier has probably been kind of nagging at me through everything else, which was that sacramentalism doesn't necessarily imply a morality.
Justice.
The issue of holy doesn't mean just.
Right.
And I would presume that fostering a sense of the sacramental commons or a sense of the sacred, the web of life, is almost a necessary horizon against which you can argue against commodification and privatization in order to have sort of a theoretical framework mm-hmm. for a more just distribution. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wish you might say more about that, because to me, increasing that sense is a key element of hope that we can create a different mindset.
Yeah.
And so say more about why you separate that.
I do think, and you said it actually better than I did, that this nourishing this sense of the sacramental is over against an utterly utilitarian mindset and way of, more like way of life. So that I think needs to be encouraged. And all I am saying is that the way in which people still understand how things are related to one another sacramentally matters immensely. Is it great chain of being, or is it web of creation? I mean, these are, great chain of being was fully sacramental. The whole universe is alive with the presence and power of God. But that didn't, of itself, make for equality of men and women. And people kill in the name of the holy. You know. So it isn't enough to declare so. Jerusalem is a picture of holy ground, contended by all sides. So we better be pretty sober about this. It isn't other elements. It's one thing not to treat it in cavalier utilitarian fashion, and sacramentalism can aid us in not doing that. But that does not suffice of itself as a morality.
There might be a way of going at the justice argued directly, you had a slide about the connection between poverty and water. Mm-hmm. And so many churches are so focused on meeting human needs. And when we try to bring up the issue of natural resources and the environment with churches, they say, well, we have so many social issues we're trying to deal with.
No.
But if you look directly at the fact of how many people around the world lack access to water, the whole basis of water for agriculture, if we can look at how to meet basic needs, mm-hmm. there's a nice list of 8 basic needs with Max Neef, this economist from Chile. You know, how do we ensure that, for example, with Africa, with the deserts expanding because of global warming, how do we organize to help provide water mm-hmm. in Africa? Or the UN just had their whole development decade for children celebration about a month ago with certain goals. And anyway, so there are some quite well-developed programs for making sure we have water for kids.
Yeah. And this session is all about trying to make those connections. Water issues are already huge. They're going to become even more so in coming years. Mel, I think we're the last one.
Weaving together some of the other themes that I heard begin to be developed this week is an appreciation for Web of Life sacramentalism is, to me, it seems anyway, much easier if you have found yourself placed in the wilderness as compared to those who find the circumstances of life have allowed them to live in and traffic in the marketplace, where a dominion sacramentalism is the mode of operation. So it's being out of control, being in a place where you're out of control and things are wild, makes you understand much more easily what should be common than if you were a person who grasps and is claiming some of that which should be common.
Okay, I think we'll just end on a semicolon then, if that's all right.